Welcome to today's deep dive. Whether you are a parent, a caregiver, an educator, or just someone who wants to genuinely understand neurodivergence on a deeper level, this is really for you.
Absolutely.
You're the learner today. And when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is usually this, I don't know, expectation of mechanical precision,
Right.
right?
Like it's a math problem.
Exactly. You break your arm, the X-ray gives you a jagged white line on a black background, and the doctor just points and says, "Well, there it is."
It's very binary. Clean.
Yeah, and honestly, it's comforting because we like things to be visible and easily categorized. But the moment you step into the world of neurodevelopment and autism, that X-ray machine is essentially broken.
Oh, completely broken. You're
Yeah.
suddenly navigating a landscape that is just pitch black.
Right, and if you're navigating that in the dark, relying on guesswork, it isn't just stressful, it is fundamentally unsafe.
It forces the child and, the caregiver to constantly brace for impact. And living in a state of perpetual bracing alters the everyday lived experience entirely.
Which is why today's deep dive is incredibly practical, but also deeply psychological. We are pulling from this comprehensive guide produced by AngelSense. It's titled Predictable Daily Routines for Children with Autism.
It's a great piece of source material.
It really is. And the mission today is to completely reframe how we look at schedules. Because when you read through this material, you realize that routines for an autistic child are not about household convenience.
No, not at all.
It's not about, like, getting out the door on time so you aren't late for work. It's actually a critical biological foundation for emotional regulation.
We really have to move past the idea that a routine is just a time management tool. I mean, for a neurodivergent brain, predictability is the literal architecture of safety.
The architecture of safety, I like that.
Yeah, if you don't have that architecture, you don't just have a disorganized day, you have a nervous system that is fundamentally disoriented.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's get right into where that disorientation actually happens because the source material flips a very common assumption on its head.
It does.
If I were to guess what triggers massive anxiety in an autistic child, I would immediately picture, big chaotic events.
Sure. A fire alarm going off at school.
Right, or a crowded, echoing shopping mall, a massive sudden life change. But the guide points out that the real friction, the daily danger zone, is actually hidden in the in-between.
The transitions, yes. It's waking up and moving to the breakfast table, leaving the house for school.
Switching activities.
Exactly. Switching from a preferred activity like reading to an unpreferred one like brushing teeth. We view these as just the, connective tissue of the day.
Yeah, just normal stuff.
Right. But for a child dealing with sensory processing differences or communication barriers, a sudden transition is an immense cognitive hurdle.
Wow.
What's fascinating here is if you look at the UK's National Autistic Society, which the text cites, they explicitly list a preference for order, predictability, or routine as a diagnostic criterion for autism.
Wait, really? So the need for routine isn't just a symptom of anxiety, it's actually baked into the neurological profile used to diagnose them in the first place.
Precisely. It is how the brain is wired to process the environment. I mean, most neurotypical brains run a very smooth, subconscious, predictive software.
Okay, predictive software.
Yeah, you transition from the living room to the car, and your brain automatically anticipates the temperature change, the physical movement, the sequence of opening the door. It takes almost zero working memory.
Right.
But for many autistic individuals, that predictive software operates differently. The brain just does not automatically bridge that gap.
So if there isn't a routine bridging that gap, transitioning between everyday activities must feel like, well, like walking down a staircase in the pitch dark where the steps keep changing
Oh,
heights.
that's a great way to put it.
You never know when your foot is going to hit the ground. Every single step is just this jarring shock to the nervous system.
That is the perfect way to visualize the cognitive load. And when a nervous system is constantly shocked by invisible steps, anxiety spikes.
Makes sense.
And when anxiety spikes, the capacity for safe decision-making plummets. That is where we see a rise in unsafe behaviors.
Not because they're being defiant.
Exactly. Not because the child is being defiant, but because they are in an environment that feels structurally unstable. Lowering that uncertainty with a predictable routine gives them a flashlight for that staircase.
I love that. A flashlight. So, if the transitions are these dangerous, invisible steps, we have to map them out so the child can actually see them coming.
Yes, you have to make them visible.
The guide says the first step for a caregiver is to literally audit the day. But looking at the criteria they suggest for this audit, it isn't just writing down a list of times.
No, it's much deeper than that.
They're asking caregivers to look for very specific biological and environmental triggers.
You have to act almost like a forensic investigator of your own daily life.
A forensic investigator.
Right. The text asks you to break down the schedule and locate the friction points. Like, when is the child rushing? When are they experiencing hunger or fatigue?
Or when are the instructions getting muddy?
Exactly. When is the household getting chaotic or unclear?
The correlation they make there is really interesting. They aren't just saying, well, notice when your child is hungry because they get cranky.
Right.
They're directly connecting those physical states, hunger, fatigue, sensory overload, to high-risk events. Like, the text asks caregivers to anticipate scenarios like taking public transit alone.
Yes.
Or moments of being unsupervised, and map how fatigue or unclear instructions might turn those specific scenarios dangerous.
Because a tired or hungry child has even less cognitive bandwidth to process an unexpected transition.
Which makes sense. We're all like that to some degree.
Totally. The audit requires you to look at those vulnerable moments and create a recommended plan of action before the crisis actually occurs.
I understand the logic. I really do. But if I look at this from the perspective of an outsider or even a skeptical relative, there is a glaring question here.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Right. If we audit the child's entire day, and we script every single minute to avoid sensory overload and fatigue, aren't we just building a sterile, airtight bubble?
That is the big question.
Because life is inherently chaotic. If we eliminate all friction, aren't we making the child more rigid and totally unable to handle the real world when things inevitably go off script?
It is a totally valid concern, and honestly one that trips up a lot of well-meaning caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
But the Angel Sense Guide includes a vital caveat here.
Okay, what is it?
The goal of mapping the day is never to avoid all schedule disruptions. I mean, you cannot eliminate chaos from human existence.
Right.
The goal is to establish a secure enough baseline that you can actively teach the value of flexibility.
Wait, how do you teach flexibility to a brain that relies on rigid predictability to feel safe?
By using the routine as a safe container for temporary change.
A safe container.
Right. The text mentions unavoidable situations, doctor visits, family vacations, sudden sick days. If a child has no baseline routine, a doctor's visit is just another terrifying, unpredictable event in an already unpredictable world.
Yeah, just another missing step on the staircase.
Exactly. But if the child has a rock-solid foundation, you can introduce the doctor's visit visually, on a schedule, as a temporary detour. You are giving them the tools to process the disruption rather than just letting the disruption happen to them.
So you're building the shock absorbers. You aren't pretending the potholes don't exist. You're giving the vehicle a way to absorb the impact without breaking the axle.
Yes, that's it exactly. And you can only build those shock absorbers when the foundational routines, what the guy calls the bookends of the day, are completely secure.
The bookends, mornings and nights.
Right. The mornings and the nights are the most vulnerable transition points, largely because they're entirely dictated by biology.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the biology aspect in this guide is staggering.
It really is.
They cite that up to 80% of the autistic population might suffer from sleep disorders. I mean, 80%.
It's a massive number.
That completely reframes the conversation. We aren't just talking about a kid who likes to stay up late reading. We're talking about an overwhelming majority of a demographic fighting their own neurology just to get rest.
The statistics highlight a profound physiological hurdle. The text breaks down the reality of this 80%.
What does it actually look like?
It means autistic individuals often take significantly longer to fall asleep. They stay asleep for shorter durations, and the overall restorative quality of that sleep is much lower.
Which means the next day doesn't actually begin when the alarm goes off.
No, not at all.
The success or failure of a Tuesday morning is entirely decided by what happened on Monday night. If a child is operating on a chronic sleep deficit, their cognitive RAM is already tapped out before their feet even hit the floor.
And that diminished capacity leads directly to the behavioral risks the guide warns about. Poor sleep drastically increases daytime anxiety, worsens meltdowns, and most critically, leads to nighttime wandering.
Nighttime wandering?
Yes. When a child wakes up at 2 a.m., isn't able to self-soothe back to sleep, and is seeking sensory input, the risk of them leaving the house quietly is incredibly high.
So securing the bedtime routine isn't just about good sleep hygiene. It is a non-negotiable physical safety measure.
Absolutely non-negotiable.
The guide's solutions are heavily structured around physical and sensory lockdown, like limiting screen time to reduce neurological stimulation,
right.
and a familiar repetitive bathroom routine, like a specific temperature bath, ensuring that nightlights and comfort items are exactly in their designated spots so the visual environment is static and unchallenging.
Notice how all of those interventions are designed to lower cognitive demand. You are signaling to the brain that no more decisions need to be made today.
Yeah, closing up the tabs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that extends to the caregivers themselves. The text explicitly reminds parents to physically verify door locks, window locks, and other wandering prevention systems every single night.
You lock down the physical perimeter while soothing the internal sensory environment.
Right.
And then you have to turn right around and tackle the morning. It's like setting up a line of dominoes. The guide suggests that the secret to an efficient morning routine for an autistic child is actually doing all the work the night before.
Yes, prepping everything.
Prepping clothing, packing school bags, lining up medications.
It seems like standard organizational advice, right?
Yeah.
But the neurological reason behind it is profound.
How so?
If you are dealing with a child who likely suffered poor sleep due to that 80% statistic we talk about, their executive functioning in the morning is severely compromised.
And executive function is what allows us to plan and sequence tasks.
Exactly. Sequence tasks make decisions.
Right. Like, which shirt do I wear? Where is my math book? Did I take my pill? For a neurotypical brain, those are minor micro decisions.
Barely register them.
But for an exhausted neurodivergent brain, each of those questions requires a massive amount of processing power.
By laying out the clothing, packing the bag, and assembling sensory comfort tools the night before, the caregiver is externalizing the child's executive function.
Oh, that's such a good way to phrase it. Externalizing it.
You're making all the complex decisions when the house is quiet and you, as the adult, have the energy.
You're offloading their RAM, setting up those dominoes. So when the child wakes up, everything falls smoothly into place. They don't have to compute a sequence of events. They just look at the preset physical cues and follow the track.
Exactly.
The guide also mentions using transition objects to help with this. What exactly does a transition object do mechanically in the brain?
It serves as a tangible bridge between two states of being.
Okay.
If you tell a child, hey, it's time to get in the car, that is an abstract concept requiring them to project themselves into a future environment. But if you hand them their specific preferred blue toy car, that they only hold during transit, that physical object grounds the abstraction. It gives their brain a physical anchor to hold onto while the environment shifts around them.
Okay, so the bookends are secured. We've externalized the morning executive function and locked down the nighttime sensory environment.
Right.
But then we hit the messy middle of the day.
The hardest part.
Yeah. And the source makes a fascinating point about why things fall apart here. Verbal instructions often just become entirely useless during sensory overwhelm. Like, you simply cannot talk a child through a meltdown.
Auditory processing is incredibly vulnerable to sensory overload.
Really?
Yes. When a neurodivergent nervous system is flooded, whether by bright lights, loud noises, or an unexpected change in the schedule, the brain begins shutting down non-essential processing centers to deal with the threat.
Wow.
Auditory processing is often one of the first things to get scrambled.
Which explains why a parent repeating, you know, put your shoes on, we have to go, put your shoes on, isn't just ineffective, it's actually making the situation worse.
That's worse.
The verbal instruction is just adding more noise to a system that is already crashing.
Exactly. The auditory information is fleeting. It exists for a second in the air and then it's gone, requiring the child to hold the instruction in their working memory.
Which is currently offline.
Right. Which is why the AngelSense toolkit relies so heavily on visual supports.
Okay, yeah. The guide lists, checklists, picture cards, color-coded pages, even placing physical stop signs near doors, bathrooms, and medication storage.
Right, because a visual support doesn't disappear.
It stays static in the environment.
Exactly. It allows the child to process the expectation at their own speed without having to decode verbal syntax.
And for moments of high stress or emergency routines, the guide highlights the first then board. This is a brilliant intervention because of its sheer simplicity.
Oh, the first then board is amazing.
When panic sets in, complex logic fails. A first then board reduces the entire universe into two concrete facts. First shoes, then door.
Right.
It removes the negotiation, the tone of voice, and the overwhelming scope of a larger task.
They also recommend low-tech warnings for transitions, like digital timers.
Oh, I saw that.
It allows the child to literally see time passing, moving the transition from an invisible shock to a visible, predictable countdown.
But you know, there is a specific part of the daytime toolkit that I actually want to push back on slightly.
Okay, what's that?
The guide highly recommends creating a designated quiet area.
Yes, a dedicated sensory space.
They suggest stocking it with headphones, calming music, lava lamps, light projectors, and having the child do breathing exercises or take movement breaks there.
Right.
Now, I fully understand why you need a safe room during a meltdown,
yeah.
But the guide suggests using this space proactively.
Proactively, yeah.
Why would a caregiver interrupt a perfectly calm, functioning child in the middle of their day to go sit with a lava lamp? If they aren't distressed, aren't you risking upsetting their momentum?
I get why it seems counterproductive to pause a good moment, but this is the difference between emergency repair and proactive maintenance.
Okay.
Think back to the computer RAM analogy we used earlier.
The background applications running silently?
Yes. An autistic child navigating a neurotypical world is constantly running high-demand background apps.
Right.
Filtering out the hum of the fluorescent lights, trying to decode facial expressions, suppressing the urge to stim. They might look perfectly calm on the outside, but their neurological RAM is slowly maxing out. If you wait until they're actively having a meltdown, the system has already crashed. The lava lamp won't help reboot a crashed system.
Oh, I see. So the proactive quiet area is scheduling a moment to deliberately close out all those background applications.
Excellent.
You remove the sensory demands of the rest of the house, let them focus on a highly predictable, soothing visual, like a light projector, and literally clear their working memory.
Precisely. You intervene before the distress accumulates into a crisis. By building these sensory resets into the daily routine, you dramatically reduce the unsafe behaviors that stem from a maxed out nervous system later in the afternoon.
That makes total sense. You aren't fixing a problem, you are preventing the conditions that allow the problem to exist in the first place.
That's the whole goal.
But we do have to address the reality of the safety net because, I mean, even if a family implements the perfect morning sequence, utilizes first, then boards flawlessly, and clears the RAM with proactive sensory breaks, the system is still going to fail occasionally.
It is unavoidable.
Especially when the child is handed off to the wider world.
Coordination is the ultimate stress test of any routine. The guide emphasizes that an isolated routine just isn't enough. You have to share it. When you hand a child off to a relative, a babysitter, a teacher, or a therapist, the environment changes. If the expectations and communication styles change too, the routine shatters.
But the text is very careful to specify that caregivers should share a simplified version of the routine.
Yes.
You don't hand a 19-year-old babysitter a dense 400-page operational manual for your child and expect them to execute it flawlessly.
Right. If the manual's too complex, the substitute caregiver will just abandon it and revert to their own instincts.
Which introduces those invisible, dangerous steps on the staircase again.
Exactly. A simplified guide ensures that the core pillars remain intact. Basic schedule steps, specific calming strategies, critical safety reminders, and the child's favored communication tools.
Keep it simple.
The goal is simply to ensure the style of instruction matches what the child's brain is expecting.
Because when the instructions don't match, the panic sets in. And that panic brings us to the most chilling statistic in the entire guide, which addresses the ultimate safety risk.
Yes.
50% of autistic kids wander.
1 in 2.
Half of them. Those stakes are unimaginably high. We aren't talking about preventing a tantrum over a missed snack. We are talking about preventing life-threatening scenarios.
Wandering or elopement is a terrifying reality, and it rarely happens during the loud, obvious moments.
Real.
No, it happens in the micro moments of system failure. A child's RAM maxes out, the environment becomes intolerable, and they simply try to leave it.
Wow.
It happens at night when parents are asleep or during a chaotic school transition. Or in the 10 seconds, a caregiver turns their back to stir a pot on the stove.
So what does this all mean? Predictable routines are the first line of defense. They keep the child's nervous system regulated, so the urge to flee is reduced.
Right.
But because human beings are fallible and unpredictability will inevitably occur, a routine alone cannot be the only safety measure.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is why the guide ultimately circles back to emergency technology.
The failsafe.
Yes. When the biological and environmental routines falter, you need a failsafe. Tools like Angel Sense's real-time GPS tracking and specialized smartphone applications step into that gap.
The tech takes over when the human element drops the ball.
Exactly. For that 50% of autistic children who are prone to wandering, having a specialized tracker isn't a luxury. It's the definitive safety net.
Right.
It ensures that when a crisis occurs and the child breaks away from the predictable environment, resolution is rapid and safe. It provides caregivers with the baseline peace of mind required to even attempt building these routines in the first place.
It is a comprehensive safety loop. The routine prevents the wander, and the technology resolves it if the system breaks down.
Perfectly said.
As we wrap up this analysis, there is a very grounded, comforting piece of advice the Angel Sense Guide offers at the very end.
I love the ending.
Yeah, because the prospect of auditing a day, mapping transitions, offloading executive function, and maintaining visual schedules, it's incredibly daunting. But the guide explicitly says you do not need to create the perfect routine overnight.
It is critical not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. I mean, the sheer mechanics of sensory management can paralyze a caregiver. The most effective approach is to start incredibly small.
Pick the single most explosive, high-friction part of your day. Maybe it is just the transition from dinner to the bathtub.
Right.
You don't worry about the whole week. You just build the visual supports, the clear instructions, and the sensory preparations for that one specific hour.
You build stability brick by brick. Fix one transition. Let the child acclimate to that predictability. And as they grow and as their neurological needs evolve, you refine and expand the system.
And as you build those bricks, you start to realize that these schedules don't just regulate the autistic child. They become a source of profound systemic stability for the entire household.
Oh, absolutely.
Removing the guesswork brings the baseline cortisol levels of the whole family down.
When the environment is predictable, everyone, siblings, parents, the child, gets to stop bracing for impact. They get to move through their own home feeling secure.
And, you know, looking at the sheer mechanical effectiveness of these tools, the visual schedules that bypass auditory overload, the proactive sensory breaks that clear working memory before a crash, the explicit externalizing of executive function, it leaves me thinking about how broadly these concepts apply.
It's a fascinating thought.
Right. If these specific intentional routines are so incredibly powerful at regulating a neurodivergent nervous system, preventing anxiety, and bringing chaos down to a manageable level, how much calmer might our own lives be if we apply these exact same neurodivergent-friendly principles to our own high-stress, overwhelmed, neurotypical adult lives?
It is a profound question. We all suffer from transition fatigue, and we all have a limit to our cognitive RAM.
Maybe we shouldn't be waiting for our own systems to crash before we step away to clear the background apps. Maybe we could all use a lot more proactive maintenance and a few more flashlights on our own invisible staircases. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep learning, and we will catch you next time.